How do you do it? How do you face hardship and suffering? What is it that you do, that you turn to, that you think of when it all goes wrong? When actually, when what you hoped for really wasn't what turned out to be? Or when actually the unexpected has suddenly come your way? They say it's those moments that can be life-changing, don't they? Those moments where suddenly you find out someone has died. Where just in an instant, in a moment, you find you're in an accident and the rest of your life will no longer be the same. Where suddenly, in a moment, in an instant, you find out the truth, which maybe for so long had been a lie. We're looking at Paul, and we're continuing to look at the life of Paul, but here we look at how Paul faced hardship and some of the hardships that Paul suffered. It would be really helpful to have 2 Corinthians open. It's page 1166 in the Bibles that are provided. And although we'll jump around a little bit, we're going to spend most of our time in 2 Corinthians this evening. And Paul here, helpfully, as we come to look at the life of Paul and the hardships he suffered, Paul here gives us a helpful list of the hardships he suffered. What have we done with the clicker? Here we go. And the things that he went through in his life. And so let me take you through some of the things that he had to cope with. It seems like a funny place to start, but Paul starts with hard work in his list. He starts off with things that he could perhaps genuinely boast about. But in his list, he goes on to boast about the things that he'd suffered. I have worked much harder, he says in the middle of verse 23. He starts to boast about the things that other people would say are weaknesses. This whole series, if you didn't pick it up, are things that he says he's boasting in the things that others would say that he was made him weak. The context here is that other people have come to Corinth. Other people are rubbishing Paul, are saying he's not up to it. And one of the reasons it would seem that they're saying Paul isn't any good is because Paul had to work. He wasn't a professional speaker. He didn't charge you like we do, you Corinthians. No, no, he didn't charge you anything. He was just sort of doing it as a hobby. You know, he had to do that job that he does, that kind of that manual labour. He's no good at all, is he? And it was a way that people made him look weak. And here he boasts about it. He boasts about the fact that he has actually worked hard. He goes on a little later to talk about labouring and toiling and going without sleep. More on that in a bit. But Paul here doesn't seem to have any expectation that the life he goes through will not involve hard work. That actually part of life is hard work. There's no expectation here of just sitting back. But points to it as one of the things, the hardships he has endured. He's had to deal with hard work. He's also had to deal with imprisonment, that he'd been arrested. He'd been in prison, he doesn't tell us how many times, been in prison more frequently than anybody else. I'm not quite sure how many times we read into that. I think I've told this story before, but it's fun, so I'll tell it again. The police once turned up at my door one morning. For those who don't know this story, and knocked at the door. I was actually in the shower at the time, and Kate answered the door, and they said, are there any men in the house? Well, yes, my husband. What's his name? Andy. Okay, we need to see him. And their foot was in the door. And so Kate came up and knocked on the bathroom door and said, there's a couple of police officers here to see you. And so I said, oh, okay, all right, I'll be out in a minute. Now, I'd had some identity theft, and so I thought, well, they've come to obviously ask me a bit about this and what's been going on. And so I say, well, I'll just get dressed and I'll come down. So I get out of the shower, go off to the bedroom, go and put some clothes. And then and suddenly there's a police officer stood at the end of our landing and going, well, you put us in a bit of an awkward situation there. I was like, well, I'm just getting dressed. He's like, I can see that. We just needed to make sure we knew where you were. And I said, well, you can watch if you want. He said he'd rather not and went downstairs. And suddenly it dawned on me that they weren't here to ask me a couple of questions about the fact that I'd had some identity theft. And so I got dressed a little more nervously Went downstairs, and as I was actually walking down the stairs, there's a couple of questions. What's your name? Is your name Andrew Perryman? Yes. Were you born on whatever? Yes. And so, well, to cut the long story short, we've been sent here by Hampshire Police to arrest you on 2 counts of theft. At which point I'm going, how did I manage to steal things in Hampshire? Or drive back through Hampshire on the way back from Dorset sometimes. Did I manage to steal things without realising? Did I take something out of a shop without really thinking about it? But twice. That would be very impressive to steal something twice without really realising it. And then they said, it's on the account of car theft. And I went, hang on a minute. I think you've got the wrong person. The situation went on from there. Fortunately for me, they believed my story that it wasn't actually me. It helped the fact that they had a CCTV photo that didn't really look much like me, unless I'd managed to lose some muscle over in the course of about 2 weeks. The person who had stolen these cars was a bit beefier than I was, which helped. And the fact I could point to some identity theft also helped. But nevertheless, it was a bit of a nerve-wracking moment. And all of this happened was a Friday morning, and it was the Friday morning just before we were due to start Holiday Club on the Monday. And I was rather late, wasn't I, Brenda, for a Holiday Club band practice that we were having that morning. I turned up a bit late for having been detained, shall we put it that way. And it raises something interesting for me, because it makes you say, well, obviously that was just something that happened. Someone has stolen my identity and done a few things in my name. And it continues to rumble on as a bit of an issue even today, actually. And you say, well, was that happening just before Holiday Club? Was that attack of the enemy? Was that actually trying to get in the way of what we were trying to do and throw me off what I was thinking about for Holiday Club? Was it just an inconvenience or just coincidence that was the timing of it? Or was it all three? Of course, there are people around the world who face suffering and imprisonment in the persecuted church, much more than my funny story about the police turning up at the door and being quite reasonable about it. The church who face the police turning up at their door and being quite unreasonable about it. Those who were imprisoned for their faith. And it takes us on actually to what Paul suffers next. He talks about being beaten in various times in various ways. I have been flogged more severely. 5 times I received from the Jews 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rod. Once I was pelted with stones. He talks about the things that he had suffered. And of course there are Christians around the world today who continue to suffer those kinds of hardships. Paul goes on to talk about being exposed to death, that he nearly died several times. Talks about natural disasters, having suffered from just the things of this world, natural things, having been in danger from bandits. I suspect there's people here who've been in danger from criminals in one way or another. Anyone suffered theft or burglary of one kind or another? Or identity theft? That's my one. Things that we still suffer from today in hardships that we have to cope with. He talks about being in danger from other faiths. My fellow Jews, he talks about, but of course, Paul isn't really regarded as a Jew anymore by this point, and in danger from Gentiles, being in danger from people of other faiths. Of course, something that we can still continue to face as a hardship today. I think our biggest hardship we can face today is actually from atheists, from those of an atheist belief, and I'm quite particular to say that it's a belief, that adamant belief that there is no God, I believe, is a faith. And I think for those who are quite militant in their views as atheists, we can face some hardships from. I don't know if you've followed in the news this last week about the Lord's Prayer and the Church of England producing this Lord's Prayer advert they wanted to show as an advert before films. I don't like adverts before films, so I'd quite happily see them all banned. But apparently the Lord's Prayer was going to be too offensive to show in a cinema before a Star Wars film. And I don't believe those kind of views would be out there if it wasn't for those of an atheist persuasion pushing faith to the margins of society. Or no, you can't express faith and your belief in that in a public sphere. That's something that you can do in your own place, in your own corner. That's what you can believe, but you're not to talk about it to anyone else. And I wonder where hardships will continue for us in that regard. Paul talks about false believers, and it may well be quite poignant here that he says false believers kind of in the middle of this section, because it may well be that he's pointing to those who've come to Corinth as being those false believers who are throwing the church there off track, who are causing them trouble. It was an issue then, and still continues to be an issue today. I believe that we struggle as church in this country because there are many in church and in church leadership around the country who may well not really believe the gospel anymore. I'm not the one who's here to point fingers at a particular individual, but the state of faith in our country is not always in a good place. It's very interesting meeting colleagues who are in the Anglican Church and their experience and the diversity that there is within the Anglican Church, of course, and their experience of some of those who they've met who minister in churches. And it's quite sometimes shocking the lack of faith that there can be. It can be a danger to us today. And then we get into things like lack of sleep. Anyone ever suffered with lack of sleep? I won't ask for a show of hands for this one, but lack of food. Of course, we have a food bank. It runs here, runs across the town. It's not a surprise to us, is it, anymore, that there are people in our town who don't have enough food. It's a hardship that's suffered. And it's not something we can say is exclusively outside the church. It's a hardship that we suffer. If people lack food, then they may well lack other material needs. Paul talks about being cold and naked. What it's probable that he's referring to there is, particularly about his travels, that when he's gone to places that are colder, he wasn't suitably attired. He didn't have the right sort of clothes for the weather that he was heading into. And that he just didn't have the material needs that he required. And of course, we meet those who lack food, so often we lack other basic needs. And Paul talks about his concern for others. I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Who is weak and I do not feel weak? Who is led into sin and I do not inwardly burn? And I find this quite helpful in some ways, because actually sometimes that is the case for us, isn't it? That some of the hardships we suffer aren't simply about things that we're coping with, but are the things that those nearest and dearest to us are coping with. I almost drew a lot of arrows over this, because actually I think our concern for others can often then lead to a lack of sleep. And actually lots of those things could probably lead back into lack of sleep, and how these things in hardships that we face can interconnect. And it wasn't in our reading, but if you skip on into chapter 12, verse 7, you read about Paul facing ill health, this thorn in the flesh that he suffered with, that amongst all these things he had to cope with ill health too. We've been going through Acts as we've looked at the life of Paul, and if you flip back to Acts chapter 27, you get a bit of an illustration of the kind of thing that we're reading about here, the kind of hardships that we suffered. Page 1124, if you want to turn to it. And chapter 27 begins with this. When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius. So, instantly, we actually read that Paul is under arrest. At this point, he's imprisoned. He's been handed over with a bunch of other criminals, and they're on their way to Rome, is the plan. So he begins, and they set out on this journey. They're going by ship, and if in that first bit of chapter 27, we read about how the journey begins, and we read kind of Paul protesting and saying, let's not carry on in this journey, it's not going to go well for us, but they don't listen to Paul, and the journey carries on. And verse 14, before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the Northeaster swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind, so we gave way to it and were driven along. So now we find Paul in the beginnings of his natural disaster here. The ship he's on gets caught in this storm and begins to be driven along. He's in this natural disaster. This is perhaps one of the things he talked about, where he talked about being in danger at sea. So they're caught in this storm for quite a while, and we read about their situation in verse 21. After they had gone a long time without food. Right, so Paul's got a lack of food. This is one of those times where he was lacking food. Paul stood up before them and said, "Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete." He kind of says, "I told you so," which I guess is fair. He did tell them not to, but, you know, seems a bit mean. "Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed." Actually, I think here we pick up his concern for others. He could have just been sat at the back kind of muttering, "I told you so," and just letting what will be, will be. But here he continues to show his concern for those he's travelling with. At verse 27, they continue on in this storm. In verse 27, "On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea, when about midnight the sailors sensed they were approaching land." So for 14 days, they've been caught in this storm, and at midnight, they spot that the sailors start to think that they're approaching land. So I reckon this must also be one of those times where Paul went without sleep. This lack of sleep, he talks about having been caught in a storm for 14 days and 14 nights. Turning over the page, we then read, after still being caught in this storm, they do find that they're near land. And in verse 41, we read, "But the ship stuck. The ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bow stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding surf." This is one of the shipwrecks, one of the three shipwrecks that he suffered. And then verse 42, "The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping." Of course, Paul is one of those prisoners. So here, actually, he comes very close to death. He's exposed to death here. If it isn't for the centurion guarding him, he would have been killed. And then, as if that's not enough, he finally escapes from the ship. The ship's been wrecked. They've fled the ship. They've swam to shore. They get onto shore on the island of Malta. And then we read about them building a fire to welcome them, because it's wet and it's cold. And verse 3, "Paul gathered a pile of brushwood, and as he put it on the fire, a viper, driven out by the heat, fastened itself on his hand. When the islanders saw the snake hanging from his hand, they said to each other, 'This man must be a murderer, for though he escaped from the sea, the goddess Justice has not allowed him to live.' But Paul shook off the snake into the fire and suffered no ill effects." So after all of that, having escaped this shipwreck and finally got to shore, he gets bitten by a poisonous snake, and everybody thinks he's going to die again. So what do we learn from this? What do we learn from Paul's hardships and this chapter of Acts? Well, I think one thing is that you don't want to travel with Paul. But I think the second thing we learn is that Paul's life was rubbish. I don't say that flippantly. But actually, you read that list. It's so easy, isn't it, to read that list, to talk about these things, and to actually kind of breeze over it. Maybe because we've read it many times, maybe because it's so tightly packed. But to actually miss the fact that really what Paul's describing here is not a happy life. It's not an easy life. The things he lacked, the things he suffered, the people who were against him. It seems bad enough, and then it seems like, you know, what would we say? It's just bad luck. Again and again, facing things that, being caught in a storm, being bitten by a snake. And then sometimes I think of the things that I complain about or that I consider hardships. And it kind of gives me pause for thought to wonder sometimes, what am I really complaining about? I do believe that hardships are something that, like all things, are relative. The hardest thing I've ever suffered is the hardest thing I've suffered. And so, of course, it's the worst thing I've had to deal with. If I face something worse, then it will be the worst thing I've ever had to cope with, which doesn't compare with the worst thing that you've ever had to cope with. There's sometimes a joke that, a semi-joke, I think, that goes around on social media, which they describe as, people use the term first world problems. You know, when you face something that's an issue that you wouldn't face in other countries around the world, that's with our society today, you know, sometimes it's very flippant things like, they didn't put cream on my latte. First world problems. Sometimes it's more genuine things. The busyness of life in our part of the world. The problem of having two cars and then having to get one of them serviced or something like this and suddenly being without a car for a day. It's a first world problem. But sometimes I wonder if we need to be reminded of the sorts of things that Paul actually coped with. But perhaps take what he says about facing hardship all the more seriously, because we know it's coming from someone who suffered a great deal. We learn from this that we're to expect hardships and suffering. That this, for Paul, was very much what the life of a believer will involve. We're told it by Jesus as well. Jesus says in Mark 13:13, everyone will hate you because of me. He says it in those famous verses in the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are you when people persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. We're to expect that things won't always be easy. The Christian life is not that walk that's meant to be a doddle. So how do we face them? How do we face these things? How do we face hardship and suffering? When we do when we've done marriage preparation with people, sometimes we talk about this kind of illustration of when we face conflict. Typically there's two responses to conflict, the rhino or the hedgehog. If you provoke a rhino, it's going to charge at you. There's some people, you may know it in yourself, that if someone provokes you, if you get in a conflict situation, you will let people know about it. You will let someone know that you're not happy with them, that they've done something that has upset you, that's angered you. The other response, at the other end of the spectrum, is the hedgehog. If the hedgehog finds itself in a conflict situation, what does it do? It curls up into a ball and kind of rocks back and forth. And there's others of us who, in response to conflict, will have that kind of response of, actually, I don't want to deal with this. I'm just going to keep it inside. I'm just going to lock it away. I'm just going to hold it in and not let anyone know, not face it, not deal with it. And, of course, both responses have their problems and their issues. One can lead to a lot of bitterness and resentment. The other can lead to a blazing row or worse. And I think the same sort of thing can be true when it comes to facing hardships. That actually we can respond in two quite different ways. That actually when we face hardship and suffering, we can go the kind of, maybe it's the sort of hedgehog end of sort of giving up. We can face it and we can just be bitter about, I've had to suffer this, and it's not fair. I've had to suffer this, and the joy and the happiness is just gone. We can resign ourselves to, this is the situation, and I'm just going to wallow in it and be miserable in it. And I think there can be a spiritual side to that too. that actually we can face something and we can say, well, our faith's just too weak to cope with it. For some reason, it particularly comes with ill health, that we can have this attitude of, if my faith's strong enough, I will be healed. And the dangerous flip side is that if I'm ill, then it must be my faith is weak. And I've known people, sadly, who in the face of suffering and hardship have decided that they're just going to give up on faith altogether. That actually they say, well, if God's not going to sort this out for me, I'm just going to walk away. I'm not interested anymore. Or there can be the other side of it, the sort of rhino end of things. That decision to, in the face of hardship and suffering, I'm going to fight it. I'm going to fight this. I'm going to fight my way through. The sort of putting on a brave face. I'll endure it. I'll cope with it. I'll work hard. I'll get my way through it. And of course, that can have a spiritual side to it too. You know, my faith is strong enough to cope with this. I'll not let this beat me. I'll stand my ground. I'm good enough. I can do it. And it sounds good, doesn't it? Sounds a lot better than the I'm going to give up end of the spectrum, doesn't it? You know, it sounds a lot better than I'm just going to give up on my faith. But actually, there's an important difference in that and what Paul says. Because Paul doesn't say, I'm strong enough. Paul doesn't say, I can do it. Paul says, in my weakness, God is strong. And I think sometimes in our desire to stand firm, stand our ground, we can make it more about us, the rhino that's fighting it all, than actually about the God who's all powerful. I will boast of the things that show my weakness, Paul says. I didn't read the newspaper article, but I picked up on what Justin Welby said about it. Apparently, Justin Welby was on Songs of Praise the other week and was talking about suffering in Paris. And in the context of a long interview, he said he talked about the fact that when things like that happen, it can make you doubt. When things like that happen in the world, it makes him doubt God. And of course, as a figure like Justin Welby, if you say something like that, there's a media person somewhere who's going to jump on it and say, Archbishop of Canterbury doubts whether God exists. And what he was trying to do was just be honest and just admit that he has weakness, that his faith isn't something that is always the same, that actually in the face of some suffering, in the face of some of the things that go on in the world, it makes him doubt, it makes him question. Sometimes the world doesn't understand if we're willing to recognise that we have weaknesses, that actually we face hard things in life. That actually we're not always able to cope with everything that is thrown at us. So how do we face it? One of the things that we can do is to recognise what hardships, what suffering can do. And the interesting thing I found as I've looked at this is that there's a lot in the earlier part of 2 Corinthians that refers exactly to this, that refers actually to what weakness and suffering can do in our lives. If you flip back to the beginning of 2 Corinthians, in fact, right at the start, chapter 1, verse 3, Paul writes this: "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles, so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves receive from God." He starts off right at the start of this letter by saying, actually, where we suffer and we are comforted, it actually empowers our service of others. That actually, because we've been comforted, because we've received comfort from God as we face trouble and hardship, it actually empowers us to be able to help others do that too. To offer others that comfort and that encouragement. It helps us to help others. It empowers our service of others. Going on in verse 7, he says this: "And our hope for you is firm, because we know that just as you share in our sufferings, so also you share in our comfort." It's not just about being able to help others, but actually it's a deepening of fellowship as we face suffering together. That actually, as Paul had that concern for others as they faced hardship, as they faced difficulty, it helps grow that fellowship. It's all one thing to sit next to one another, to chat with each other, to laugh with each other. But I tell you, you really get to know someone, you really grow in relationship with them when you cry together. I don't think there's anyone I need to explain that to anymore. But actually, the people that you've cried with, that you're willing to cry with, are some of the closest people. Actually, we grow together as we face hardship together. Paul goes on, picking up from verse 8. "We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about the troubles we experienced in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death, but this happened so that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead." As we face hardship and suffering, it helps us to trust in God, to let go of trusting ourselves and to trust in Him. It helps us to trust in God. A couple of chapters later, we pick up more of what suffering and hardship can do. Chapter 4. Chapter 4, picking up from verse 7. "But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that his life may also be revealed in our mortal body." Then actually, it reveals Jesus in us. That as we suffer, as in our way we carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so also his life is revealed in us. Paul takes that on to what perhaps is its logical next conclusion in verse 16. "Therefore we do not lose heart, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. Since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. For we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands. Meanwhile, we groan, longing to be clothed instead with our heavenly dwelling. Because when we are clothed, we will not be found naked. For while we are in this tent, we groan and are burdened, because we do not wish to be unclothed. but to be clothed instead with our heavenly dwelling, so that what is mortal will be swallowed up by life. That actually, hardship and suffering even prepares us for heaven. What's described here is this eternal body. That actually, it prepares us for that eternity. And this is so important, because one day we will all die. We all have to face up to our own mortality. And it's one of those things that actually we have to recognise before we face it. We were talking about this as elders just the other morning and saying actually it's something we need to come to terms with before we have to face it, because in the brink of it, it's so difficult. That actually passages like this, where it helps us to recognise that as our bodies do decay, as we do feel that we're wasting away, it is preparing us for an eternal future. It's what is mortal fading away. And it's pointing us towards the fact that there is an eternal body waiting for us. Hardships prepare us for what's next. And of course, all of this really builds character. And we pick that up in what Paul says in chapter 12, turning back to page 1166. We talked about the illness that you cope with, the thorn in the flesh. It says in verse 7, because of these surpassing great revelations, therefore, in order to keep me from becoming conceited, I was given a thorn in my flesh. But actually, Paul recognises that this hardship he suffers, this thorn in the flesh, we don't know exactly what it was. I think John was talking about that just the other week, the number of different theories as to what exactly it was. Whatever it was, he recognised this hardship that he pleaded with God to be taken away and wasn't, helped his character. It stopped him becoming conceited. Stopped him becoming proud and arrogant of all that he had done. Actually, the sufferings, the hardships we face can deepen our character. And it's all very good, isn't it? It's all very helpful for how we face some things. And I can kind of accept all of my own advice there for some things that I face, for some things that go wrong in life, for some of the things that were on that list that we went through at the beginning. You know, it's a bit like going to the dentist, isn't it? If you're here and you enjoy going to the dentist, just know that you're strange. But you go, don't you? Because you kind of know that it is good for you in the end. And that if you don't go, you'll end up in a lot of pain. And, you know, it's the right thing to do. It keeps things in vaguely good order. And so you can kind of accept some hardships like that, can't you? You can face it going, okay, I know that somewhere in this is doing good to me. You know, the police knocking on the door it's a good illustration, it's funny, and somewhere in there it's doing some good for me. But there are times, of course, where asking or answering the question of how we face hardships with, well, what suffering does, what does it do, how does it help us, just really isn't good enough, is it? Where it doesn't really cut the mustard. I don't think I face much of that in my life, personally. But when I think about Kate, my wife, that her mum died a week after her 10th birthday, and the impact it has on her and her family, and continues to do so, I don't think I can say that what hardships do, their benefit, makes it okay. What happened in Paris just a few weeks ago? The innocent lives, the people who in just a few hours their life has been changed and children orphaned. I don't think I can say that what hardships do makes it okay. And that's where I'm pleased, relieved, that what we find from Paul, who faced such terrible things, isn't an explanation that says, oh, it happened because of this. Isn't the kind of, oh, one day we'll see why it all happened. But what we have is a promise. What we have from here, from God, that he gave to Paul and Paul gives to us in verse 9 of chapter 12, is the promise, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. It's not an explanation, but it's a promise. It's a promise that in whatever we face, God's grace is sufficient to cope with it. We could go back in Corinthians, 2 Corinthians still, it talks about calling, 2 Corinthians 3 verse 4, it talks about God supplying the competence that we need for what he calls us to. 2 Corinthians 9 verse 8 talks about God providing our material needs, all that we need. And of course here, we see God giving Paul the strength to overcome this thorn in his flesh that actually shows him that his grace is sufficient. It's sufficient and it strengthens God's grace. It's God's power that's made perfect in our weakness. It is grace that strengthens us. It's a grace that transforms us. Here it changes Paul's view on what he suffers. Paul pleads with God to take away this thorn in the flesh. But God doesn't. And God says, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. It changes Paul from pleading with God for it to be taken away to actually recognising that God is the one who's able to overcome, to give him the strength in the face of that weakness, of that hardship. It changes his view from saying, God, I can't do this if I have to face this hardship, to saying that God can do it even with the hardships that I face, even with my weaknesses. The story goes that a French mystic wrote to a friend who was suffering and coping, struggling with a great deal, and said to her simply this, if you only knew what power there is in an accepted sorrow. I wonder if that's what God did for Paul there. Helped him to accept the hardships he faced and found great power in the God who's able to deal with it. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. So perhaps we can learn and grow through the things that we face. And perhaps when that just isn't enough, we can be honest on the weakness, the hardships that we just can't cope with, and allow God's power to give us the strength and to be at work in us. Let's pray. Father, I thank you that you are the God who was able to bring Paul through all this horrific list of things that he faced. That you are the God who gave him the strength to do all of this. As a man who declares to us his weakness. So Lord, I pray for each one of us, that we can recognise our weakness. To bring it honestly to you and to one another. That we might rest in your promise that your grace is sufficient, and might find strength in your promise that your power is made perfect in our weakness. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.